bench, Tory MP Sir Charles Walker is understood not to have submitted a letter of no confidence in Johnson himself. But on Saturday night, Tory backbenchers who have been trying to crunch numbers said they thought those wanting to ditch Johnson were only 10 to 20 short of the 54 letters that need to be submitted to the chair of the 1922 committee, Sir Graham Brady. Some Conservative MPs said they believed that around 40 to 45 letters were in or pending, while another estimate that was circulating suggested the number was closer to the early 30s. The Observer understands that several MPs who have yet to go public are likely to put in letters early this week before MPs go away for a 10-day recess on Thursday, 10th of February. One Tory source said the recess would be a time for the Prime Minister to regroup, so there will be an incentive to get the names in before then. The Tory MP for Wimbledon and former Minister Stephen Hammond said he was considering very carefully this weekend whether he still has confidence in the Prime Minister, and added that it certainly looks like the beginning of the end for Boris Johnson. If and when Sir Graham Brady receives 54 letters, he would then consult the Prime Minister on when a vote of confidence among all Conservative MPs should take place. If Johnson then failed to win a majority, he would have to stand down. The mood has turned further against Boris Johnson in recent days, after he criticised Sir Keir Starmer in the House of Commons recently for failing to prosecute the child abuser Jimmy Savile during his time as Director of Public Prosecutions. The baseless attack on the opposition leader led to the resignation on Thursday of Boris Johnson's longtime aide and head of policy at Number 10, Munira Mirza, who had demanded that Johnson apologise, which he failed to do. Investigations by The Observer showed that the claims about Keir Starmer were being promoted before Johnson aired them by far-right groups, including the UK branch of Proud Boys, a violent white nationalist organisation labelled a terrorist entity. After Boris Johnson made the comments in the House of Commons, other notorious far-right groups, including football hooligans linked to the anti-Muslim English Defence League, as well as the nationalist organisation The Traditional Britain Group, lauded him. The charge appears to have roots in the far-right's obsession with the suggestion that the establishment is protecting child abusers. On Saturday, 5th of February, the Culture Secretary, Nadine Dorries, repeatedly sought to blame Remainers for plotting against the Prime Minister during a round of media interviews. However, out of 15 Conservative MPs who have so far publicly called on Boris Johnson to go, just seven of those backed remaining in the European Union in the 2016 referendum. Among the leavers who have said Johnson should go are David Davis, Andrew Bridgen, and most recently the former Education Minister Nick Gibb. Nadine Dorries told Times Radio, "There are a small number of voices, whether they are people who were ardent supporters of Remain, who see this as their last opportunity to reverse Brexit." Hammond, a Remainer, described Nadine Dorries' remarks as predictable rubbish from a predictable source. In a further blow to the Prime Minister, his actions during the Partygate scandal have been blamed by scientists for a sharp decline in the number of people getting a vaccine booster. The number of people being boosted dropped below 30,000 a day, with only 64.6% of the UK population over the age of 12 receiving a third dose of the vaccine or a booster shot so far. Behavioural scientists said declining trust in the Prime Minister, as well as the belief that the Omicron variant is mild despite its impact, were behind the fall in vaccine take-up.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello and welcome to Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. I'm your host, Robert Carter. An electrifying direct action campaign is sweeping through Britain. The target, Israeli arms firm Elbit Systems, which produces drones and arms which have been used against innocent Palestinian civilians. Through a fascinating alliance between the local community and activist group Palestine Action, Elbit successfully chased out of the English town of Oldham in January. Today, we'll be focusing on the anti-Elbit campaign and exploring ways to capitalize on these victories. But first, Bianca Rahimi gets us started with this special report that looks at the campaign which forced the hand of Elbit in the sleepy town of Oldham.
Elbit Systems is Israel's largest arms manufacturer. At the end of 2021, it had 10 sites across the UK and 4 subsidiaries. Today, it only has 9 sites across the UK and only 3 subsidiaries. This is the story of how an activist group, in tandem with the local community, courageously stood up and shut down an Elbit Systems arms factory in the British town of Oldham. The fingerprints of Elbit Systems can be found everywhere, from Israel's drone killing of 4 Palestinian boys playing football on the beach in 2014, to the apartheid wall in the West Bank, which the International Court of Justice has deemed illegal. From the anti-migrant infrastructure in Arizona to Kashmir occupied by the Indian Army, Elbit Systems shareholders are always the profiteers. UK-based activist group Palestine Action has launched a relentless campaign to shut down Elbit factories in the country through direct action. They claim to have carried out almost 100 actions in a year, causing almost £20 million worth of damage to Elbit's operations. Their defense is that criminal damage to stop war crimes is no offense. There is yet to be one conviction of Palestine Action activists of any crime in British law. They claim Elbit Systems is afraid to follow them into court, where the reality of its operations would be discussed openly. Throughout Israel's May 2021 campaign in Gaza, in which it killed hundreds of besieged people, displaced thousands, and destroyed much vital infrastructure, Elbit factories in the UK were key focal points for protesters. During that time, Palestine Action shut down an Elbit factory in the city of Leicester for 6 consecutive days. Initially, the fire brigade was called in to remove them. However, they issued a statement in solidarity with the protesters and refused to follow orders. They were joined by hundreds of people from the local community who prevented the police from removing the Palestine Action activists on the roof of the factory. Across the country, communities linked arms with Palestine Action protesters, hoping to uproot the arms company from their communities. One such community was in the town of Oldham. They, in coalition with Palestine Action, launched a weekly protest outside of the Elbit subsidiary for anti-technology. British Iraqi hip-hop artist Loki also joined them outside the factory, performing his song Long Live Palestine, while a group of Palestine Actionists shut down the Elbit base. Following many months of weekly protests, it became clear that Elbit's presence in the community was just not tenable. The company not only withdrew from Oldham completely, but it sold its toxic brand Ferranti Technology for around £10 million. The shutting down of Elbit Systems in Oldham is what bottom-up community-enforced BDS looks like. With Palestine Action continuing its sustained campaign to shut down Elbit Systems arms factories and communities across the country waking up to the enemy within, how much longer can Elbit maintain its presence in the UK?
To discuss the expulsion of the Merchant of Death, otherwise known as Elbit, from Oldham, we're joined today by 2 expert guests. David Miller is an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David has co-authored a number of reports investigating the Israel lobby in Britain and the European Union. And Huda Amori, a co-founder of the Direct Action Group, which has changed the face of activism in the UK, Palestine Action. She's a well-respected Palestinian and Iraqi campaigner in great demand, so we're very happy and very lucky to have her in the studio with us today. Thank you very much to both of you for joining me. I'm going to go straight to you, Huda. Thank you so much for coming all this way to London to be on the show. Now, obviously, you guys, Palestine Action, must be ecstatic at the results that you've achieved in Oldham, but this obviously took a great community mobilization as well as your leadership on this campaign. Could you just tell us a little bit more about that? What kind of support, what kind of reaction have you been getting from the community?
Yeah, I think from day one, as soon as people became aware that there was an Albert factory in their community, people came out and were outraged by the fact that this was happening just in their doorsteps, especially in a community where many of the population are Kashmiri, who strongly resonate with the Palestinian community. And to find out and to expose that there is a company on your doorstep which is literally building weapons which they market as tested on Palestinians and is used to oppress and murder other people across the world, I think the community response matched that outrage. And week in and week out, you know, through rain, when there was little media attention on it, they still went out through Christmas to go outside the factory and protest against it. And every time there has been a direct action at the factory, we've seen an immediate response from people coming out, showing support at the stations, coming to the court dates. I mean, this has been a very intense campaign to get rid of this factory, and one which couldn't be done without the local community stepping up and supporting the actions and taking part in the actions themselves.
Now, Huda, to be fair to the other side of the argument, Elbit claims that the move was actually based on a kind of restructuring of the company and so on. I forget how they worded it, but they worded it very differently to how Palestine Action did. What's your response to that?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, going into and doing this type of campaign where you're trying to get rid of Israel's largest arms company from British soil, we know that Elbit are never going to put their hands up and say, well done, Palestine Action, you've won, we're done. And so their response was to be expected, but it's also quite funny because it contradicts what they've been saying in the past, last year, when they're boasting about Francis Technologies, how well they're doing, etc. And actually part of their strategy, Elbit system strategy, has been to acquire as many businesses as possible, not to be selling off businesses. And also the dramatic loss that they've made as well on this sale of Elbit Systems in Oldham. I think it was in 2010 when they bought it for £15 million. And here we are 12 years later and are selling it for £9 million. So if you take in inflation, that's a massive loss to the company, and obviously isn't something that Elbit will be buzzing about, basically.
For sure. And, you know, the fact is the locals of that community were happy to see them gone regardless of what the reason was. But obviously your work has clearly played a role there. David, I'm going to come and bring you in on this now. Obviously, you know, the Palestine Action movement in the UK has been on for a very long time, but it seems like what Palestine Action has been achieving and doing now sets a new precedent. I mean, an arms factory basically shutting its doors and fleeing, in lack of a better word, from a community following this campaign. Is that a first? Is there anything else that's come close to what Palestine Action has achieved?
I mean, it's a new model, isn't it, for Palestine solidarity work in this country. In the past, Palestine solidarity work has involved demonstrations, yes, it's involved lobbying, but this kind of alliance between, on the one hand, direct action and local community participation is, to my mind, dramatically new. And you add to that then the involvement of the official trade union movement through the fire brigades union refusing to remove the protesters. That is a recipe for disaster for Israeli interests in this country, and it's one which, you know, you can see being reproduced across a whole range of other areas, not just in relation to Elbit, but in relation to a whole series of other Israeli and indeed Israeli military activities in this country.
Huda, I want to ask you a little bit about your personal connection to this cause. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you originate from the region which has been devastated by Western imperialism and the colonialist project going on in Palestine. Mm-hmm. So perhaps it resonates with you a lot more than it would, say, me or David. Could you just give us a little bit of insight into what has led you on this path to this type of activism that you do?
Yeah, definitely. So I am from a Palestinian background and Iraqi background. My father's Palestinian and my mother's Iraqi. And I was lucky enough to grow up in in Britain. And I say that because the majority of my family are living in the Middle East, and the majority of my mum's family, for example, were living in Baghdad throughout the US-UK invasion and the imperialist militarism that took place over there, which basically did what it meant to achieve, which was destroy the country and cause horror over the people living in Iraq. And we see the same thing that happened in Palestine. My father's family were forced out with brutal force. They were in the front room of their house when the Israeli military came in and just started shooting aimlessly at the window in their home. The way that they managed to escape was basically by crawling to the back of their own house with just the clothes they had on their backs. And actually, my great-grandfather was shot and killed by a British soldier shortly after the Balfour Declaration was issued in historic Palestine. So I think for me, but also for, I think, most British people, there is a connection, a very deep connection between Britain and Israel's apartheid regime, going back to the Balfour Declaration. And here we see today that they are allowing these companies, and I think we would never have to build a campaign or take this type of action if it wasn't allowed that these companies can operate and literally have the audacity to be supplying an illegal occupation and blockade and apartheid regime, and have the audacity to market their weapons as tested on a captive population. And it's the fact that that is allowed to happen, and that Britain's continuing complicity with Israel, that we have to take such drastic action. And I've been involved in lobbying, petitions, nationwide BDS campaigns, which have had some successes. But in truth, it didn't match the severity of Israel's apartheid regime, and it wasn't enough to truly challenge it. And I think as we see ties deepen with the governments of Britain and Israel, it's up to us as people now to take the power back into our own hands and stop appealing to the oppressors.
Now, we are going to discuss a bit more about the situation and elaborate on your points as well, Huda. But before we do that, I do want to bring up this next report. It was from my visit to Oldham. I was very lucky to get to attend community celebrations outside the former factory of Ferranti Technologies, one of Elbit's subsidiaries in the UK. Here's a glimpse of all the action as I saw it.
Joy and jubilation was the mood in the English town of Oldham as Palestine Action led celebrations following the news that notorious Israeli arms manufacturer Elbit Systems had sold its site in the area. The move was announced following a high-pressure protest campaign, which Palestine Action believes is the reason for Elbit's move.
Activists in Oldham and the surrounding areas have been protesting outside this facility every week for the past 29 weeks. Combine that with the direct action taken by the Palestine Action Group, the pressure on Elbit Systems to abandon this facility has been both immense and very costly.
The site has been hit numerous times by volunteers who have blocked entrances, sprayed blood red paint, and damaged business property, allegedly costing Elbit millions.
We will continue doing this everywhere there's an Elbit Systems, everywhere there's a company that's complicit with the Israeli apartheid regime. And we will continue and do everything we can from here in England and Wales and Scotland, where the Balfour Declaration was declared, which caused the problems that are now stemmed, that are in occupied Palestine, and we will continue taking action, escalating our actions until Palestine is free.
Officially, Elbit hasn't confirmed their reason for abandoning the site, claiming that their sale was part of a restructuring strategy. V did attempt to contact Elbit for clarification, but they refused to respond. Whatever the reason, locals are thrilled and consider this a win for Palestine. Robert Carter for Palestine Declassified.
So there you have it, but it isn't all fun and enjoyment for the Palestinian cause at all. In fact, there is obviously a lot of hard work and struggle that goes into it. David, I'm going to bring you in now. Obviously, you have faced some difficulties in the work that you've done standing up for the Palestinian cause, highlighting what the Israel lobby has been up to in the UK and elsewhere. It's actually cost you your position at Bristol University for the time being. Given how much that was publicised and all the attention that that story got, compared to the lack of attention that Palestine Action and their work has been getting, do you think that there's Do you think that there's a reason for that, a kind of conscious decision that the mainstream media are going to divert attention away from the activities of groups like Palestine Action towards issues related to what offends the Israel lobby, such as the story relating to you?
Well, it's certainly the case, isn't it, that Israel's views get much better hearing on the mainstream media, BBC, ITN, Sky News, than do the views of the Palestinians and their supporters, and that's been demonstrated by every single study that's ever been done of news coverage. So we know that the news is institutionally biased in favour of the Israeli narrative. But I think there's a wider question, which is about how our whole society responds to the human rights abuses that we see every day in Palestine. And that is that there is a very strong lobbying effort which is intended to stop our society responding in any decent way to the abuses faced by the Palestinians. Now, in the case of Elbit, I mean, Elbit was a firm originally called Soltam, set up by a guy called Zablodovich, and his son took over the firm, Chaim Zablodovich, who now runs various companies in London, including estate agents and shopping centres and hotels in Israel, etc. And they are at the centre of the Israel lobby. Zablodovich himself funds Bicom, the main Israel lobby group in this country, and employs people like Luke Hakehurst, the Labour Party councillor, who's also on the NEC of the Labour Party, who's a former, of course, as you'll know, arms lobbyist for various different arms firms. So there's a very strong relationship there between arms companies and the Israel lobby in this country. Zablodovich himself was involved in funding many years ago now Liam Fox, the former defence secretary, who was forced to resign, and funding him in meetings in Israel, which involved meeting with the head of Mossad. So we know pretty well what's going on there. That's a whole nest of influence peddling, which is very much in alliance with the secret state in Israel. And that's the background to some of this stuff we see with Elbit, is that it's not just a business question, it's also an ideological question, in which there's much money put into the attempts to influence British decision makers. And that's, you know, in many cases, in this case, it has been very successful. And it's only popular pressure from below, like in the case of Palestine Action, which can push that in the other direction. And that's why I'm very hopeful that this kind of victory that Elbit has had will be replicated in other areas, and many more companies which have got which have collaborated with the apartheid regime will be driven out of the country.
Now, Huda, as I mentioned earlier, those scenes of celebration in Oldham they're quite rare, if I'm being honest. Obviously, you have recorded other victories in the past, and there's been some amazing action, but what people don't always see, including supporters of Palestine Action, is what happens to activists after the initial direct action takes place, the court action, the legal battles which ensue afterwards. Could you just tell us a little bit about what you guys have had to deal with after this action? And I know there was a recent court victory, actually, mm-hmm. which perhaps you could highlight to the audience.
Yeah, definitely. So for some context, before Palestine Action launched, there were some direct action against Elbit. It was more sporadic and less often, and not a single case had actually gone to court. Every single case was dropped before trial. And since Palestine Action, we've obviously upped the ante. It's a sustained campaign. There's higher levels of damage, and it makes the factories basically unable to operate. So they've obviously pushed for prosecutions now. But overall, in terms of, you know, the response and the backlash, so to speak, we've had continuous raids, I think over 50, 60. We've lost count at this point. It's almost become standard that if someone gets arrested for Palestine Action, their home will be raided, which is actually a power that the police have but don't often use, especially in these type of cases. So that's become very often. We've seen police brutality, we've seen brutality by security guards. Passports have been seized during Palestine Action's campaign by the state illegally, and fictitious charges of blackmail have been brought. But overall, what we're actually seeing is when it comes to court, and they've now been in a position where Elbit and the CPS are forced to take these cases to court, we are winning. And we've had two trials so far. The first trial was in a magistrate's court. Three activists who openly admitted to throwing bottles of red paint and blockading the factory were found not guilty on the fact that what they did was more than proportionate compared to what Elbit does. And we've seen just today, we heard the news that the second case to go to trial, which was three women who took action against the landlords of Elbit's factory in Shenstone, who again openly admitted to paint and throwing red paint, etc., and stopping the operations of the landlords for at least the day, had their charges dropped by the judge during the trial. But I think overall, for us, you know, we expect these kind of challenges, and it's not easy. Obviously, it's not easy, but we expect when you're fighting against something which is so daunting and huge, and you know, Israel's largest arms company, you're not going to win or be effective without having some serious pushback. But for us, those obstacles have to be overcome, and you have to keep going in order to get there in the end.
I think it is very telling that although obviously you've suffered this type of what appears to be police harassment, if I may be so bold as to say, the fact that you're still recording legal victories on the legal side of things, the battlefield there, clearly shows that public opinion, I think, is very much on your side, regardless of what lobbyists or politicians may say about you. But David, I'm going to come to you on this. We haven't got long left of the show, so I want to ask you about your opinions on the future, what it may hold. Having seen what Palestine Action are doing and have achieved so far, what do you think about the future? Do you think that if Palestine Action continue this type of work, we may see the end of Elbit on British shores, for example?
I think we face the possibility really quite soon of a much wider collapse of the Israeli apartheid regime. There are challenges for it in many countries, not just in this country. And there will come a moment where it's not possible for the Israeli regime to continue with its activities. And the Elbit story, I think, is a small part, but a very significant part of that story. It may be that we chase Elbit out of this country altogether, but I wouldn't think that that's the end of it. We face the possibility of quite significant BDS victories. We've already been having them all around the world. There is a campaign against normalization of the Israeli regime all around the world. And I think that we are on the cusp of really quite significant victories. And the Elbit thing is a straw in the wind in that respect. It's a very significant victory in this country. In the overall scheme of things, it's a small step on the road to victory in Palestine.
Less than a minute left, Hudra. I just want to give you an opportunity to anyone who wants to support Palestine Action, wants to help you out more. What do you need?
I think if you're in a position and you're considering taking direct action, join Palestine Action. People can sign up on our website. When you join, you'll be given a call. There's many workshops so people can understand the theory of direct action and the different and what comes with it, including the legal consequences, etc. If you cannot join and take direct action physically, still sign up. There are many different roles for people to take in Palestine Action, from police station support, court support, and of course, donations are more than welcome. We obviously don't get any money from governments or companies, etc. We do rely on just normal people. And to be honest with you, we don't spend that much money at all when it comes to shutting down these companies, but we cost Elbit a lot of money.
To both of you, thank you so much. And to you, Huda, thank you for the work that you do for Palestine. I think a lot of our audience will really admire you for the stance you've taken. And David, I'm sure I'll see you again very soon. That is all the time we have on this edition of the program. But thank you for joining us. We'll be back next time for more news from Palestine. It's bye for now.
Arabi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Arabi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Arabi English Radio.
the limelight.
Hundreds still dying from COVID infection each day in the United Kingdom as fear of the virus wanes. Although Omicron is less deadly than previous variants, it remains a significant health risk to the estimated 5.1 million unvaccinated people aged over 12 in the United Kingdom. And the rolling 7-day average of deaths in Britain is above 240. We have prepared for you an article written by James Tapper. The piece is titled Booster Campaign Stalls in UK as Partygate Undermines Trust in Official Advice. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. British scientists are saying the COVID booster campaign has stalled and declining trust in the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is part of the problem. Only 26,875 people in England had a third dose or booster shot on 1st of February, the latest complete figures available, and 6 million people are at least 6 weeks overdue for their shot. Behavioural scientists, including government advisers and public health leaders, say the huge drop in take-up in just 1 month is fueled by the widespread belief that Boris Johnson flouted his own COVID rules. Although the Omicron variant is less deadly than previous variants, it remains a significant health risk for an estimated 5.1 million unvaccinated people in Britain aged over 12. And the rolling 7-day average of deaths in Britain is above 240. Double-jabbed people have a substantially lower risk of dying, but they remain more vulnerable to infection that can lead to long-term health problems and being taken to hospital, as well as death in some cases. According to behavioral scientists, the perception that Omicron is less dangerous is a major reason why only 64.6% of over-12s in England have had their booster shot. The winter surge in infections has also had an impact, since people have to wait 28 days after their infection has cleared before they can be boosted. Referring to the Office of National Statistics data published recently, John Drury, Professor of Social Psychology at the University of Sussex, said, "Worry about infection has fallen to 52% of adults. You can trace that the 27th of January when the government announced that we didn't need to have any measures. That communicates something about risk, that infection is okay because it's not associated very strongly with death." University College London's COVID social study, which has tracked attitudes to pandemic measures, released a report recently showing that unvaccinated and double-jabbed people were much less worried about catching COVID, becoming seriously ill, developing long COVID, or possible future variants. But they were more concerned than triple-jabbed people about being asked to get more vaccinations. Drury said, "In addition, most people who aren't vaccinated have chosen not to because of a lack of trust. And who has trust in this government now?" Research by Dr. Simon Williams, a behavioral scientist at Swansea University, showed that the Partygate scandals had created variant fatigue, with some participants in his December study saying they would ignore rules at Christmas because of the Downing Street parties. He said trust in authorities has taken a battering recently, adding, "One of the predictors of vaccine decisions is trust in authorities. We saw that in a big study in Denmark and trust has certainly not got any better recently. He cited opinion polls showing declining trust, including a YouGov survey in December, showing that 1 in 10 people would not follow COVID rules. Professor Susan Michie, director of the University College London Centre for Behavioural Change and part of the SPIB group that advises the government SAGE group, said, "We know vaccine hesitancy is often associated with not trusting authority. The get boosted message was heralded by the Prime Minister, and recent events have meant that trust in politicians has decreased, undermining the get boosted message." The National Health Service has been attempting to reverse the decline in booster uptake by reminding people to come forward. It sent texts to 2.4 million people recently and has opened 1,000 walking grab-a-jab centres. It is also working with employers to vaccinate people in workplaces. Dr. Emily Lawson, head of the NHS England Vaccination Programme, said new Office of National Statistics research showed the risk of death involving COVID was 93% lower for people who had had a booster or a third dose of vaccine compared with unvaccinated people. Dr. Emily Lawson said, "It is vital that as soon as you can get the vaccine, you take up the offer and book a guaranteed slot online. Despite the Omicron variant seeming milder, it is important we don't lose sight of the fact that COVID is still a very serious illness that is affecting thousands of people's lives every day." Dr. Douglas Brown, the chief executive of the British Society for Immunology, said, "Three doses of the vaccine doesn't completely stop transmission, but the rate of transmission is halved between people." He noted immunocompromised people, such as cancer and kidney patients, did not respond as well to vaccines as those with healthy immune systems. Dr. Doug Brown added, "By getting your booster, that reduction in transmission really does play an important role in not just keeping ourselves safe, but those who are more clinically vulnerable as well." Professor Maggie Ray, president of the Faculty of Public Health, said, "I know people are tired. I know the government wants to move on, but we will only be able to get through this with people getting the vaccine. We need to establish who hasn't been vaccinated and how we can help them." National Immunization Management System data shows that by 11th of January, 78.7% of people over the age of 18 in the richest areas had had a third dose of the vaccine, compared with 46.9% in the most deprived areas. Office of National Statistics data shows that 35.9% of pupils eligible for free school meals have received a first dose of the vaccine, compared with 58.9% for those not eligible. Professor Maggie Ray said, "It is heartbreaking to see the discrimination and the health inequalities between the poorest in our country." She said that ministers must continue to fund the vaccination program, adding, "I think the Treasury is trying to recoup the money that it spent during the pandemic, and they want the COVID response money back. I think it's right and proper that some of the private sector spending on test and trace does go back, but I'm not convinced all of it was spent effectively. But what I don't want is further cuts to the public health system." Professor Maggie Ray noted that the booster campaign was introduced at the last minute. Throughout this pandemic, they have been 3 weeks behind every sensible action or decision. The first lockdown was a classic example. The virus has outrun them the whole time. Professor Maggie Ray added, "We need to keep up momentum because we've still got another few months of winter to go with all of the vulnerabilities that brings. I'm not comfortable that 350 people a day are dying in our country. I think that's shocking. absolutely shocking.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has provided some sanctions relief to the countries that had nuclear cooperation with Iran under the terms of the 2015 multilateral agreement. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Friday signed several sanctions waivers related to the 2015 Iran deal, also known as the JCPOA. The waiver covered the conversion of Iran's Arak heavy water reactor, the provision of enriched uranium for its Tehran research reactor, and the transfer of a spent and a scrap reactor fuel abroad. The exemptions allow foreign companies to resume cooperation with Iran on its nuclear projects. The waivers are part of the 2015 accord. They were canceled by former U.S. President Donald Trump after he withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and reimposed anti-Iran sanctions. The latest U.S. move reverses the Trump administration's decision and lifts the sanctions threat against foreign countries and companies from Russia, China, and Europe that had been cooperating with Iran under the terms of the JCPOA. The media cited a U.S. State Department report as saying that the step is meant to facilitate the Vienna talks on the revival of the agreement. Meanwhile, the waiver announcement prompted hawks in Washington to accuse the Biden administration of giving concessions without securing any commitments from Iran. Senator Bob Menendez has asked that the president adopt a tougher position on Iran. He called for new efforts, including creative diplomatic initiatives, stricter sanctions enforcement, and determination from Congress to support President Biden's declaration that Iran will never get a nuclear weapon on my watch, something that Iran has repeatedly denied seeking. In addition, these waivers will not entail financial relief to Iran, though there remains a strong case for upfront humanitarian relief, as it is the people of Iran who have suffered the most under U.S. sanctions. Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are set to resume talks in Vienna. Iran says an agreement hinges on the removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington won't pull out of the deal again. Iran says there have been positive developments in the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna, but they do not fulfill Tehran's expectations. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the 2015 nuclear deal hasn't had any economic benefits for Iran in recent years. Amir Abdullahian says Tehran is firmly and explicitly seeking a good deal that would guarantee Iran's economic benefits reliably and sustainably.
I think it is a symbolic pitch. So I think the Joe Biden administration can do better than that, and by starting to lift all the sanctions on the frozen huge amount of money. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars frozen in foreign banks that belong to Iran, and that will be a positive step, not a symbolic step.
A day after the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden restored a sanctions waiver, which was rescinded by his predecessor Donald Trump in May 2020, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Washington must show goodwill on the ground, not on paper. He also said, "We demanded the guarantee at all political, legal, and economic levels. Agreements have been reached in some areas, but the Iranian negotiating team will seriously pursue getting tangible guarantees from the Western sides that they will abide by their commitments under a Vienna deal." That's in reaction to recent comments by U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, who said Washington cannot guarantee the next administration's adherence to the JCPOA. Iran has time and again stated that one of its main issues is to get the necessary guarantees from the other parties, especially from the West in the Vienna talks.
Well, there is no guarantee for Iran that even Joe Biden, after the signature of this deal that is going to be signed or will be signed and soon, perhaps in the next couple of months, is going to be respected. There are no guarantees that the U.S. is going to respect the deal, and certainly no guarantee that the next administration will abide by it.
Also, Iran's top security official Ali Shamkhani says real, effective, and verifiable economic benefits for Iran are a necessary condition to reach an agreement in Vienna. He said making a pretense of lifting sanctions is not considered to be constructive. He added that Iran has the legal right to continue developing peaceful nuclear capabilities. His comments came as Iran is now awaiting a political decision by the US and European countries for a breakthrough in the sanctions revival talks in Vienna.
Eastern Europe has once again turned into a tinderbox in recent weeks amid a war of words between the United States and its allies on the one side and Russia on the other. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to attack its western neighbor Ukraine, citing thousands of Russian troops stationed along Russia's western borders. The Kremlin, however, has strongly denied the allegation, saying it has deployed the troops as a means of self-defense in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Even Ukraine, a U.S. ally, agrees with Russia on this. Ukrainian Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov has downplayed the threat of an all-out war in Ukraine, blaming the rising tensions on the international media. Also, President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on the West to stop stirring up tensions, arguing that warnings of an imminent invasion are putting Ukraine's economy at risk. Regardless, the U.S. continues to fan the flames of tensions. Washington is now claiming it has information suggesting Moscow will conduct a false flag attack to justify its invasion of Ukraine, but it did not provide any information to back the intelligence findings.
The U.S. captured huge pieces of territory by beating up on Spain, and they used a false flag there, Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam. The incubator babies in 1990 that started, you know, was enabled the first war in Iraq. The WMDs, the invisible WMDs in Iraq in 2003. You know, in Libya, the invisible airplanes, apparently Russian satellites just couldn't see them, that were supposedly strafing protesters. That, by the way, no one had any video of in Benghazi and Tripoli, that enabled the bombing and destruction of Libya and the murder of Muammar Gaddafi. The U.S. does this all the time. Russia, there's no example of that that you can point to, although the State Department spokesperson Ned Price yesterday acted as if there was a long tradition of these actions by the Russians. And so what the U.S. is doing, the simple, short answer to this is it's called misdirection, or projection as a psychiatric term that they use.
It's not the first time the U.S. is making such accusations. Last month, U.S. officials said Russia was preparing to fabricate the pretext for a large-scale operation in Ukraine, an accusation that Moscow slammed as unfounded. China and Russia are strengthening their ties. That's the key takeaway from the meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. It was the first in-person meeting the Chinese president has had with another head of state in about 2 years. Meeting on the sidelines of the Beijing Winter Olympics, the two leaders, in a show of solidarity, stressed that their strategic cooperation was unshakable, warning the West to stop its eastward expansion. The Kremlin said Putin and Xi discussed the need to broaden bilateral trade in national currencies due to unpredictability surrounding the use of the dollar. The announcement comes after U.S. President Joe Biden's threat that Russian companies could be cut off from the ability to trade in dollars as part of sweeping sanctions in the event of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Describing the meeting as warm and substantive, the Kremlin hailed the relationship between the two major powers as an advanced partnership with a special character.
But if China decides that their reciprocal sanctions are going to include we're not selling you any more stuff, then Americans won't have televisions, cars, toasters, refrigerators, all kinds of other things. So the U.S. has been using this as a weapon, but the image I have in my mind as I watch things unfold is of a person that's painting the floor all around them until they end up in the corner by themselves and the rest of the floor wet. They're stuck in the corner.
In a lengthy joint statement, they opposed NATO expansion and accused the U.S. of stoking instability in the region. The two sides also decried the military alliance's Cold War approach to international affairs. For years, the former Soviet Union and the United States were locked in geopolitical tensions dubbed the Cold War that risked escalating into an all-out war between the two nuclear superpowers. Times have changed since then. The next Cold War could drag on for much longer and prove devastating to all aspects of life on Earth.
Israel is widely viewed as a destabilizing force in the West Asia region. It has started many wars over the past decades against regional nations. The occupying regime's hostile actions are unending. Right now, it is enforcing its expansionist policies in occupied Palestinian territories by building on lands that the international community insists must be given back to the Palestinians. The regime has gained notoriety for committing crimes of apartheid against the Palestinian people on a very large scale. Parts of Syrian and Lebanese territories are also occupied by Israel. The regime routinely carries out airstrikes against Syrian army positions. Among other destabilizing Israeli actions in the region are high-profile assassinations of top nuclear scientists in Iran and sabotage operations against Iranian nuclear energy facilities. The list of Israel's destabilizing activities and crimes seem endless. Despite the regime's record, some regional states have been getting close to it. The United Arab Emirates seems to be leading the way. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in September 2020 as part of a U.S.-backed initiative that also includes Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. Days ago, Israeli President Isaac Herzog made his first visit to the UAE more than a month after Naftali Bennett became the first Israeli prime minister to visit the country. The president of the regime, widely blamed for regional insecurity in the most volatile part of the world, said ironically that Israel supports the Emirates' security needs.
So it's like bringing the fox in to protect the chicken house. That's not going to work. You let them in, they take over. If you want a good example, look at what happened to the Catholic Church when they signed an agreement with Israel. Israel got everything it wanted, and they never fulfilled one of the obligations that they said they would fulfill. And the situation for Christians in Israel is worse now than before they signed that agreement.
During his visit to the UAE, Herzog discussed security and bilateral ties with Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. Sheikh Mohammed said Israel and the UAE share a, quote, common view of the threats to regional stability and peace. Israel is notorious for creating insecurity in the West Asia region. Why are some Arab countries getting close to the regime and claim they want to enhance security? A few days after Herzog's visit, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian issued a stark warning about the Israeli regime's presence in the region. In a phone call with Emirati Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation, Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, Amir Abdullahian described Israel as a quote-unquote threat to all regional countries, urging efforts to prevent those who create tensions from gaining a foothold there.
What would be the consequence of the Israeli regime gaining a stronger foothold in the region? Palestinian resistance group Hamas has also reacted to Herzog's visit. It said such visits encourage the occupation to continue escalating its aggression against the Palestinian people and denial of their rights. The Palestinians, who already face an uphill battle against the occupation, have described the normalization as a stab in the back. The equation in the region has become increasingly complex, keeping observers guessing how it will evolve.
For centuries, Iran was governed by monarchies and autocratic rulers, and the last dynasty to rule was founded by Reza Shah Pahlavi in 1925. During his reign that lasted for 16 years, Reza Shah replaced Islamic laws with Western ones as part of reforms that drew public discontent. In 1941, he was forced to abdicate the throne to his son, Mohammad Reza. The new Shah maintained a close relationship with the U.S. His government was known for its autocracy and focus on westernization, as well as a disregard for religious and democratic measures in Iran's constitution. Mohammad Reza Shah was largely criticized for political corruption and the oppression committed by his secret police, known as Savak. He established the service with help from Israel and the CIA. Its main aim, to monitor opponents and repress dissent. Savak's practice of torture and executions of the regime's opponents made it the most notorious and feared institution in Iran prior to the Islamic Revolution. In 1963, the Shah launched a series of reforms known as the White Revolution. Although the reforms brought some progress to Iran, they were met with a strong criticism from the public. The opposition to Shah and his White Revolution was spearheaded by Ayatollah Khomeini, a prominent religious figure who believed the Shah had embarked on a path toward the destruction of Islam. In June of that year, Imam Khomeini delivered his famous sermon at Fazia Seminary, where he strongly criticized the Shah's policies. After that speech, he was arrested, and that sparked 3 days of mass rallies nationwide, with his supporters saying 15,000 people were killed by police. After spending 8 months under house arrest, Imam Khomeini was released. But he remained a strong and outspoken critic of the Shah regime for its policies, including its close cooperation with Israel. In November 1964, Imam Khomeini was rearrested and sent into exile for another 15 years. But popular support for him grew even further during his absence. Opposition to the Pahlavi regime continued to spread, with Iranians outraged at a high inflation rate, a widening gap between rich and poor, and the repression of freedom of speech. Anger was also high at the royal family benefiting the most from the country's oil revenues at a time when thousands of poor people were suffering under austerity measures to curb the inflation. Popular rage was further ignited by the death of Imam Khomeini's son Mustafa at the hands of Savak. His death on October 23, 1977, set off a chain of mass demonstrations that grew in the months ahead and turned into a campaign of civil resistance. To appease the protesters, the Shah regime launched reforms and pledged to do more. However, none of those measures were welcome, with the protesters remaining steadfast as insisting that the monarchy must be overthrown and that Imam Khomeini should return home. The anti-Shah demonstrations started growing in their millions nationwide, despite a heavy-handed crackdown by the military. On January 16, 1979, the Shah and his family finally left Iran for Egypt. And nearly 2 weeks later, on February the 1st, Imam Khomeini returned to Tehran with a promise to form a government that would have popular support. On February the 11th, the Pahlavi regime was overthrown and the Islamic Revolution emerged victorious. And on April the 1st, Iran became an Islamic Republic in a referendum voted for by more than 98% of the electorate. The period from February the 1st to 11th is known as Dahe Fajr, or the 10-day dawn in Iran. Every year, Iranians celebrate the Islamic Revolution that brought an end to 2,500 years of monarchical rule in their country.
hearty congratulations to all our listeners on the 43rd 10-day dawn celebrations marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution.